Good evening, and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we here at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, particularly if this is your first time around, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please, please don't forget that the uniqueness of this show is that we have an archival feature, and you can go in at any time within 24 hours and listen to the show multiple times at any time of the day or night. Just look for that big red heart with the cracks in it. And so welcome, everybody. Good Saturday evening to you on a lovely Saturday. This is Donna, otherwise known as Lady Justice, and welcome to our show. And I have to tell you ladies and gentlemen that, as always, I'm very fortunate to not just have any co-host with me, but an actual president. Can you believe that? I have a president as a co-host. Not Barack Obama, but Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity, and I'd rather have her than Barack any day. Welcome, Delilah. Come on in.
Oh, you're crazy.
I would. Yeah. You're more fun.
I feel so honored now. I feel so important. I don't think of it that way too often when you have like a one-man show.
Well, you are important because we're each other's guest today. And I want to let the listeners know that Imagine Publicity, in my opinion, is on the cutting edge regarding what's happening with all kinds of social issues and crime victimization and the works of many, many talented authors. And believe me, I think that if it wasn't the best company around, I wouldn't be hanging around her water cooler for nearly 2 years here. And so I really, really encourage everyone to go to Imagine Publicity. Delilah has so much to offer there, multiple specialties for client services. But it's not just about client services and, providing marketing and promotion, but it's about getting to know people. And I really think of it as a family, and I feel very fortunate. So please, please do stop by and make sure you take a gander at what is there and get in touch with her if you have any inklings that you need some reinvention. What can I say about me? I'm not sure what's new and exciting. I always have some new writings coming up in terms of blogs. There is a book of sorts in the works, but that's going to take a very long time, so I won't get into that until it's much farther down the road. And, I am going to be going to the Melanie Eileen Rieger Crime Victim Conference at the end of May, and I haven't told this to you, Delilah, but maybe I'll be your roving reporter if you'd like.
I think that would be great, Donna, because, we had Sam and Wanda on your show at the very beginning, and they're a wonderful couple, and the conference that they put on is, it's one of the best in the country. Although, I don't know what the numbers are as far as attendance each year, but they always have really, really good presenters and training classes and a lot of different things. It's a big variety of things that go on in that conference, and I don't think it's as well known as it should be.
Right, and maybe I can put up a couple of my former posts about that again, but I believe it's the 30th and the 31st, and like I say, I will be going, and I'm sure we'll see many of our Connecticut friends. Michelle Cruz, a state victim advocate, I'm sure is going to be on a panel and speaking. Many of our the other people that are sort of biggies in crime victim circles are going to be there. Mary Fetchett is the keynote, I believe, who's the head of the Remember 9/11 organization, and many other people. So I just wanted to mention that. And I think what I'll do as our game plan, because we're kind of informal today, we're doing something very different. Maybe toward the end, the last 10, 15 minutes, if I can remember, I will go through my schedule and just let people know about some of the really stellar guests that we're going to have on Shattered Wise, because I just am very proud of this accomplishment and the people that are going to be on. It's always such a joy and such a, you know, an education to have people on. So I think we'll do that. So that's kind of the game plan at the end. But, you know, today I pushed for this show because I thought it'd be a nice change of pace. And as the promo said, we, in terms of movies, we're doing selected movie reviews. And what do we learn from movies? I have a couple of ideas just in general, and maybe Delilah, you can give me yours. When we think about the landscape of movies, this is kind of what I think of. We learn that life is imperfect, and that movies are about the human condition. Typically, the most interesting movies are something about the human condition. I also think that I wonder, and these are questions I could pose, are they truly a reflection of real life? Is that the purpose of movies? Or is it just a form of escapism? I think today movies are mostly superficial. If we look at the younger generation, and you know, a lot of times it's about superficiality, and they don't really want to deal with the issues, the real issues. And therefore, that's why imagine publicity is so valuable, because your clients, your professionals deal with the real issues, the hard issues. And there are those occasional movies that we have now that come along that just take your breath away. I don't know what else we learned from movies. What do you think, Delilah?
Well, you know, if you think back in movie history, I think, you know, when movies first came about, it was all about entertainment. They, you know, they told a story within a certain time frame. Then you had musicals, and, you know, the music was always very important in a movie. So I think in the beginning there was more of an entertainment value. Then, you know, you kind of got into the 50s, 60s, and everybody wanted realism. And so then you saw a lot of movies come out with a lot more graphic, a lot more nudity, a lot more bad words. I mean, you know, it was portraying, you know, I think one movie I remember.
Smoke anymore, though, Delilah. Have you noticed that? They don't smoke anymore.
I know. You know, one movie that back, I don't remember what year it came out, probably the 60s or the 70s, was kind of portrayed police officers, you know, an undercover detective was Serpico. Remember Serpico? And the realism,
well,
and what he went through, and it was something totally different than an MGM musical, definitely.
As a matter of fact, it's so funny that you say that. One of my two movies that I'm going to talk about a little bit in more detail had the same director, the Running on Empty movie that was directed by Sidney Lumet. And he directed 12 Angry Men, Dog Day Afternoon, which was the classic with Al Pacino, and he directed Serpico, Delilah. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. So
yeah,
You're all full of the movie knowledge, a lot
more
than I am.
I'm not really that good, but I try to do my homework before the show, you know, so I don't look like too much of a fool. But I think you're right in terms of the time frame and the types of movies that we do have. But still, our job here, we focus on the shatter of of the human condition and life and murder. And it would be easy for me to pick out just two movies about, you know, like Bonnie and Clyde or something like that. But I wanted to pick out a couple of movies that I had that were talked more in general about the human condition and were shattered in different kinds of ways. And, well, since I already mentioned Sidney Lumet, why don't I kind of just go into it a little bit. I had seen these originally on Netflix, and I've bought my own copies because I love a couple of these so much. And I really do. I love the older movies because I think they have so much meaning. Running on Empty is a movie made in 1988. It's nearly 2 hours long. It stars Judd Hirsch and Christine Lotti and River Phoenix, as well as Martha Plimpton, who looks exactly like Jodie Foster. I thought it was her. And it has a few themes. It involves a crime, a federal crime, that shapes their entire family's life. It's also about love. Love of family, love of music, and the first romance. It's about loyalty, loyalty for family, loyalty to oneself, and it's also about letting go of the past, the parents letting go of children. How this story goes is that, let me read a description from the plot. Running on Empty, directed by Sidney Lumet, is a moving tale of a young man whose parents were political agitators in the 1960s. Ever since, the family has been changing locations, changing their names, and hiding from the FBI. The young man wants to pursue a career in music, but he fears that his ever-changing identity will eventually expose his parents. Well, that's not the greatest description, but what I have to tell you is that the kinds of sacrifices, as the story goes, this family has two children. One's about 17 and the other's about 12 years old. And back in the early 70s, they were protesting against the use of napalm, the Vietnam War. Were very involved in all kinds of environmental type things. And as it turns out in the story, there was a University of Massachusetts research lab, and they put a bomb in there, and there wasn't supposed to be anyone there. Evidently, a janitor was there, and he was blinded and paralyzed as a result of this. As a consequence, this family goes on the lam for all of these years. They change their names at every address they're at. They change their address, social security numbers. They change their family status. They have to think of a new story. They change the children's hair color. They make the children sleep in the daytime so that at night they can leave. They have code words, and in those days it was payphones. So you get on the phone and you say, to the underground, they're helped by the underground to keep in touch a little bit with family. The cat needs to be fed means something else entirely. They essentially, you know, are on the run their entire life, and the children have learned to fall into line with this lifestyle. But the there are side stories going on. It just so happens that the oldest son is very proficient in classical music because Christine Lotti's character, the mother, was trained before she left, and so he's very talented. And what happens is that eventually the son gets involved in music school program. They recognize his talent, and they want him to apply to Juilliard. And the music instructor's daughter is someone that he has a relationship with, and he is so tormented about telling the truth or continuing to go on this facade. and what happens toward the end, you know, whether or not I want to, don't want to give the whole thing away, whether they have to make a, whether he confesses things, there's some very heavy scenes in it with respect to, will the parents let him go on his own? What consequences will that be? Will they give themselves up and risk going to jail? What will they do? I mean, it's an ultimate sacrifice. And, you know, when you think about it, in that situation, they're being very selfish. So that, do they decide to let the children have their own life, or do they keep running and being on the lam?
You know, and I was looking at the movie, there's several things that you mentioned that popped into my mind as well. I mean, we have, you know, we have two, I would say, call them activists, if you would.
Right.
You know, I remember back in the 60s when I think this movie was based on Bernadette Dorn, who was part of the SDS, and they did go around and bomb these labs and different places. But what I got out of it is, here you have two parents. Yes, there's a lot of loyalty, love, and all the nice things that you said, but I think any parent instills certain values in their children. They maybe even don't even mean to, but by their examples, by the way that they live, you know, by the way that they interact with society, they're instilling those values on their children. And in this particular movie, you know, they're doing that despite the consequences to these children. And I thought one part of it where she said, you know, it's just not fair. They didn't do anything wrong, and yet they've spent their whole life running and hiding. You know, how I think it probably affected these children a lot differently than it would was portrayed in the movie. I think it would probably be a little more traumatic for them. I don't know that, you know, that they would have turned out as well as they did.
Right. It seems like they're really obedient soldiers, you know, both of them. They didn't really portray the younger son that much. But what I was thinking was, when I was watching it again, the father said, we cannot break rank. We're a unit. And the son, River Phoenix, it's almost a role reversal, because he is actually the most mature person of the four, and he kind of becomes the father. He comforts the mother when things happen, and, you know, he makes the ultimate decision, well, should I stay with my family, or do I choose my own life? I mean, you know, I just can't believe that someone would be faced with this situation. And I think Judd Hirsch is supposed to sort of be like an Abbie Hoffman kind of a guy. But, you know, I just think that it's a very powerful movie. I mean, it would never happen again this way if not for, you know, what happened in the 60s. But it's a shatter on so many levels. And I think that, you know, it has many layers. And I think the acting here is wonderful, and for people to have to make those choices. And ultimately what happens in the end, I won't say it's cliche or predictable, but there are a few surprises. But I highly recommend it. I think it's an excellent movie. And particularly those that are younger than we are, so they can appreciate what happened during that time. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's almost a history lesson as far as, you know, a lot of the different things that went on in the 60s and you know, what price people paid for it. And, you know,
right, and there are a couple of side stories in here too. The whole aspect of Juilliard, there is a connection there with grandparents that he's never seen, and the talent that he seemingly has. And, you know, whenever he goes somewhere, there are no records that follow them, and they perpetually have to think of all of these little lies at every little aspect of their life to keep up this facade. And it's so stressful. And another scene that is so very touching, and it's with let's see, what's his last name? Stephen, the guy that's the prosecutor in Law and Order, he plays the father for Christine Lottie, and she ends up meeting with him, and that's a very powerful scene, as well as the so-called confession of River Phoenix with his girlfriend about what's truly going on. So, you know, in a word, I would recommend that as, one of the movies. I don't know if there's other things you want to add to this one. Since you're just a tad bit older than me, and maybe you can add something there that I didn't.
Well, there again, you know, looking back and as you grow older and wiser and you look back, you see things that were, you know, I think the first time I saw the movie was probably back in the 70s. When I don't know, when did it come out? Do you remember?
It came out in 1988, actually.
Oh, I guess I probably
did. You
did.
And what it portrayed 1971 era of when,
right.
this was supposedly happening.
Right.
So anyway, so, you were probably older than you thought.
Yeah, exactly. But I was going to it was the first time I saw it, you know, you're kind of rooting for them to get away with it. But then, like I say, when you get older and wiser and you look back on these things, it's, you know, they did a wrong. They did wrong. They bombed this place. Someone was injured very badly. And yet, you know, they were portrayed as the heroes in the show.
That is a good point. Where's the accountability?
There was no accountability for them, but yet, like I say, back in 1988 when it came out, you know, that era, and actually back in the 60s or the early 70s when this was going on, I did feel differently about it. I probably would have been somebody that would harbor them. I remember, you know, when Patty Hearst was on the run, and she came very close to the town I was living in, so they say, you know, and... You know, you're rooting for them to get away with it.
Right.
So,
well,
things
come full circle.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, they do. Well, you, like I say, you get older, you understand things differently. You have a totally different outlook on what these people were doing. But and as I look at it now, there again, the same thing comes up is what did they do to these children by their lifestyle, which, you know, all parents put their lifestyle onto their children. That's just part of being a family. But this type of a lifestyle was just not, you know, normal, of course, but it also put them in a lot of danger.
It sure did. They were all in danger. And I think I would have harbored the children if they had a chance to break free. In fact, she poses it to her father, the grandfather, will you take him so that he can go to Juilliard? And I won't reveal how the end goes, but that question is posed. And but I would never harbor the parents, but in order to help the children, I think I would. But so anyway, I mean, for me, in that era, I think this is a 5-star movie, but you know I just believe that it has a lot of value on a lot of levels. Should I go over to my next movie now? Maybe. Okay, one that I agree with, one that I identify with in so many levels. Now this one was made in 1991, and again, it's another Christine Lottie movie, just purely coincidentally. In fact, I think she's sort of one of my favorite actresses. After Helen Mirren, she's my favorite. I think she has so much range. And this time, she's paired with William Hurt, and it's called The Doctor, okay? The Doctor, and it's a coming-of-age kind of story, and it is actually based on a book called A Taste of Your Own Medicine by Dr. Ed Rosenbaum. These are some general themes. It's about a skilled surgeon whose arrogance kind of blinds him to the true values of life. The shatter of his life, their shatter in respect to his health, his livelihood, his marriage. And another aspect is that the doctor becomes the patient, and he has a very, very hard transition with this to be on the other side of the fence. And that's what's the beauty of this movie, too, to see almost this complete metamorphosis for the better. And another general theme is how one deals with grief. There's family, there's friends. How does he deal with it? And in with that aspect, there's you know, it's very interesting to see it play out. He totally pushes his wife away, but yet there is another person with a brain tumor who was misdiagnosed, or they thought, oh, it's nothing, it's stress, take aspirin. Well, by the time that she was diagnosed, it became stage 4 terminal. And again, it deals with, I guess here is the crime, if there is a crime here. It's an indictment of the system, whether it's the medical system or the criminal justice system. My opinion, at least 50% of the time, both of the systems suck, excuse my language. But, you know, being a product of 55 surgeries and being a clinical medical speech pathologist for 20 to 25 years, I've seen the best and the worst, you know, on both sides of the bed. And I have to tell you that the medical system is just as bad as the criminal justice system. And this doctor is served up a taste of his own medicine. Some key scenes. In the beginning, they really show what he's like before his own surgery. There are wonderful scenes with his friend with the brain tumor, June. She knows she's dying, and she tries to tell him that, you know, he's an arrogant SOB. And he tries to make amends by trying to fulfill one of her dying wishes, and she's never gone to a particular concert. So he's going to get them tickets to drive across the desert in Las Vegas. And she says, stop, we don't need to go to the concert. And there's a beautiful scene where they get out of the car at sunset, and they just dance in the sunset. And, you know, it's so touching. It's not about getting to the concert. It's about experiencing, you know, a moment of a good quality of life where he is her friend. The other scenes, you know, he is in a semi-private room when he's going to be diagnosed. I failed to mention that he is diagnosed with laryngeal cancer, which means growths on your vocal cords. And instead of his roommate, they give him an enema, and it's supposed to be meant for his roommate, and he can't talk and he can't tell them. So that's just one little example of how the medical system screws things up. The scenes in the end with his wife, where he, for the whole of the movie, has pushed her away, cannot bring her in for some reason, has preferred to see June, his friend. He's using a whistle to communicate, and he realizes the error of his ways. His friend has died. He's grieving. He wants his wife. She doesn't know what to do, and it's wonderful. There's beautiful scenes with them. And toward the end of the movie, two things happen. There's a total change in the way he deals with his residents and his interns. And this reminds me of what Melissa Kahn said, Delilah, last week. They say, oh, the terminal in room 3 and the, you know, the heart transplant in room 5 or whatever. And he berates them for referring to them as that because they are people. They have names. They have identities. They have feelings. They're embarrassed. They're sick. And these are the very, very important lessons that he learns as a patient versus being a doctor. And he makes them experience these feelings by assigning them diagnoses and makes them strip and put on the little Johnnies and stand in front of him and said, You're going to be a patient with these diseases for 3 days so that you know how this feels. It's the only way I can teach you, which is, to me, brilliant because I've been in that vulnerable position 55 times. And then, you know, the ending of the movie is very sweet, too, because there is a Hispanic family, a man that has a heart transplant, and he takes such good care, and he is the doctor, and he is so compassionate with them. And I have to say, too, that music, there's a lot of music in this movie, and it really has its place. And if I didn't say so, so did the other one, which I could get back to. They never did this for me, but they play music in the operating rooms now when they operate, although I hope it doesn't take away from their attention. But there's a particular song, a couple of side stories are going on. There's a very ladylike nurse, and she'll never sing this song because they sing this country song, "Why Don't We Get Drunk and Screw," which is a stupid song. But she refuses to sing this song in every operation. And then when she gets to assist with the doctor's throat surgery, she finally does this as a favor, which is just wonderful. There's some great comedy scenes. Mandy Patinkin is in this movie, who's a brilliant actor, both Broadway and movies, and he plays one of the doctors in the practice. There's a lawsuit going on in the movie, like I say, it has many lessons taught and lessons to learn, and on many levels, I so relate to this movie, and I think every doctor in practice who should watch this movie, it's mandatory. So I don't know. What have you seen this movie, Delilah? Do you have any comments?
Yeah, well, you pretty well covered it.
I did?
I think I got about the same thing out of it. I'm not a real fan of the medical system that we have and the way that, I guess in a lot of practices there's a very big arrogance with doctors, and I think that's what we see in the beginning of that movie is his arrogance. And, you know, he's holding people's lives in his hands every time he performs a surgery, but yet didn't take it very seriously,
right.
By having that ability and having that gift, really. I look at surgeons as really having a gift, because it certainly isn't anything I would ever be able to do. But, yeah, he got knocked down a few pegs, and I think in the end he became a very likable person. He wasn't, to me, in the beginning of the movie.
No, he was not whatsoever.
Mm-mm. And he kind of redeemed himself, and I think that's, he learned the lessons, and he learned compassion the hard way. I mean, he had to go through what he went through in order to learn compassion for his patients and how to teach that compassion to his students.
Right.
I thought it was brilliant.
Yes, and there's one little example that kind of and he goes over the top. There is some patient that is suing the practice, and toward the end of the movie, the man that's going to sue the practice, they see him in a parking garage, and I believe after his heart surgery, he had a stroke, because you see him communicating and he's struggling, and he can't convey that he's locked his keys in his car. So the doctor goes over to the car, and the other guy say, "Hey, wait a minute, don't do that. He's suing us." He said, "Oh, forget about it." And he's trying to help, and he says, "Don't worry about it. I work here. I can get your car keys out." The guy is almost in tears because he can't get his keys. He can't communicate. And I'm like, oh, my God, that is so beautiful. That's the way it should be, you know. So
yeah.
That's just a little snapshot of a doctor coming full circle. And let me tell you, I could write my own book on this topic, believe me. And, you know, maybe I will someday. Tutelage. Huh?
You better get busy.
I know, I'm running out of time, right? I'm getting old. Well, maybe you'd help me, Delilah.
Yeah, I hear you.
But anyway, I got so much on my plate, I don't know what to do. Maybe
you know,
someday.
One thing I was going to tell you, one of my favorite movies that just came to me, you know, I'm old and I only remember things after I should have. Huh. But you probably have seen The City of Angels with Meg Ryan and Nicolas Cage.
I think, but I'm not sure of the details. Can you refresh us on this?
That was actually one of my favorite movies. And it,
okay,
here again, it kind of speaks to the human experience in a little different way. She is actually the surgeon in this movie. And when I was looking at the doctor, it kind of reminded me of that when they were in the surgical suite playing the music, only I think she played a little more classical once in a while.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
Other music. But the music through this whole movie is fantastic. In fact, I don't buy movie tracks, but I bought this one. It was that
really
good.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, what's it about?
He is actually an angel, and
okay.
he falls in love with her, but yet, you know, he can't be with her because of the fact that he is an angel. So he has to, you know, he goes through his mental trauma, so to speak, and she goes through hers, and they fall apart, they come together, that kind of thing, and he's always kind of there for her. But he I can't remember what reason he was made visible to her. But anyway, as it comes out, I mean, his big decision is, does he want to give up being an angel to become human again to be with her?
To be with her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's my very quick synopsis. There's just so much more to it. You'll have to rent it on your Netflix sometime. It was
right. Or these will be available at Amazon too, right?
No, I'm sure.
I'm sure they are. If people want to go and see them, I'm going to have to rent that because I don't remember seeing that, so I definitely will. Here's another one. We can kind of go back. A few weeks ago we were talking with Tim Palmbach, the forensic scientist, and he is going to be involved in the new trial for Michael Peterson. Remember the three Petersons in a pod? Everyone read that blog, please. there is a particular movie, and it's a docudrama. It's about a 6-hour movie, and it's written by a French filmmaker, Jean-Xavier de Lestrade, and it depicts, I think this is what I wrote in Netflix, it depicts the real lives and deaths of gripping courtroom scenes and family gatherings following the aftermath of chronicling the case of author Michael Peterson, who was convicted in 2003 of the murder of his second wife, Kathleen. There are far too many Peterson murderers running about, right? Scott, Michael, and Drew. However, the portrayal of this real-life occurrence is done over a period of several months from several points of view and condensed into 6 hours of viewing. It is an intimate, unprecedented view of family relationships, raw emotion, secrets, legal strategies, expert consultations, courtroom drama, and even international intrigue, tying a previous, quote, accidental killing of the same type to this defendant. It engages the viewer from the start with its storytelling abilities, cast of characters, timeline, and musical offerings. I viewed this about three times. And I say here, let me see, I'm reading through this. In reality, his life and marriage was far from the perfect portrayal, and I think our client Diane Fanning gets at this in her book. He was not the perfect husband, and in fact, there are many of us that think that he did indeed do this. I think that they omit that there's physical evidence that was omitted that would prove his guilt, and that this family did survive. They were adopted. They were blended. They were divorced. There's intercontinental forces going there because the first wife was from Germany. That would go against making this a strong non-traditional family. And I think the viewer does have empathy for many of those involved. But again, Michael Peterson in this movie, and again, it's told from the defense's point of view, comes up as a self-absorbed, pathetic kind of figure. From what I know from this, and, you know, I take the position, the motive, he tried to portray that he had a perfect life with this woman, and they had a lot in common. He was an author. She was wealthy. He was not. He kind of lived off her money, but he also happened to be bisexual, and he was having, erotic experiences with escorts and whatnot. And as the defense so clearly put it, especially in that part of the country, they don't take kindly to that type of thing. And this was a lady who would not take kindly to this type of thing. They kept saying, well, there was no motive. Well, of course there was motive here. And if
that's one of the things that, you know, you brought up was the fact that it's one thing to be in a marriage and yet you're bisexual, but to keep it a secret from her and for her to find out about it, I can imagine that it was devastating to her. That she, you know, he was definitely not the man that she thought he was, and
right.
The way he portrayed himself. So you look at his pattern of conduct throughout their whole relationship, and even go back way, way beyond that in Germany when the other woman went down the staircase.
Right.
You put all of those things together, you know, and a lot of people get crazy about circumstantial evidence in a trial. However, when you look at so many cases, yes, you have to keep them all separate. Yes, they all have to be individual. But when you connect the dots in something like this, you know, I'm sorry, whether the blood spattered properly or not, I really
right.
don't care. I think the guy's guilty as hell.
Right, and that was there's a big contention there with regard to, and Dr. Henry Lee was hired by the defense, and he is saying, and his team is saying, that it doesn't make sense what he did. And there's also this really weird theory that has come up in the last intervening years that there was some type of owl, O-W-L, for those of you that don't understand my New England dialect. And they supposedly, they thought maybe that this owl got caught in her hair and, like, you know, pecked her head or whatever and caused all this bleeding and whatnot.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm serious.
If this owl came down and pecked her in the head, did they find
yeah.
owl feathers anywhere? Is there any evidence that there was an owl in the house?
I read something. I'm going to have to go back. Like, maybe it's even in my blog. I know I read it in my research that this was one of the new theories. But I don't know. Maybe we should ask Diane about that. I think we should to see if that holds water at all.
The name of Diane Fanning's book is called Written in Blood. And she actually attended the trial.
Yes.
And, you know, with the experience that she's had attending trials and researching for her two crime books,
right.
I kind of take her word for it. I think she's got a lot of expertise in that area.
She does. And one of the big reasons why they're having another trial, in addition to the controversy about the blood evidence, spatter evidence, is that this FBI guy they had hired for the state, this Devers, he was, and please do go and rent this, he was such a buffoon. He did not know what the hell he was doing. It was clearly so obvious that he was incompetent in how he went about things.
Oh,
he totally messed it up. And that's another reason for him to have a new trial, I guess.
What was Devers' role? I don't remember.
He was the expert in trying to explain, you know, what happened with respect to her falling down the stairs and the blood evidence for the prosecution. And
okay.
Henry Lee was for the defense, you know, but it is very clear that this guy Devers was really, he really was a buffoon. And so on that basis alone.
I don't think we brought up when we talked to Tim Palmbach, but, you know, personally, I really have a problem with paid expert witness testimony. I really
oh, yeah.
do. Because then, you know, it, going all the way back to the OJ case, it comes down to the money. It comes down to who can afford the best expert
right.
witness. And then you have the fact that, you know, okay, you have Henry Lee here who has a, you know, a stellar reputation, but he's gotten knocked down a few pegs simply because of the fact that he gets paid for his testimony. So it looks like, okay, if the defense is going to pay me this much, then my testimony has to be skewed towards the defense.
Right. Well, they all claim that they don't. And to his credit, Tim does this on his own time, I believe, or with certain cases that he takes on his own. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't accept it as
you know,
part
I'm
of
not. I'm definitely not
right.
putting either one of them down.
No,
I think
no.
they're both super excellent people. I think, you know,
right.
I've gotten utmost respect for what, you know, the work that they do, and I
However,
think everyone should know how
arrogant.
Many cases they, how many cases they take pro bono, which,
right.
you know, that doesn't come out. You don't hear about that. But I guess going back to, you know, paid expert witnesses in the court, I have a problem with it.
Right. Well, clearly, too, this family, it was very non-traditional, and, you know, I didn't understand, you know, there were three daughters and how one daughter broke away. I mean, initially they were all defending Michael Peterson, and then one daughter broke away and she saw sort of the error of her thinking, and she decided that, no, he was guilty. This was the daughter of his second wife, the biological daughter. The other two who were adopted because their mom died, which was the other lady that died in Germany, they were staunch advocates. There was no way in heck that Michael could be guilty, and they just didn't want to hear about it. They were totally in denial that this guy could do anything, and oh, the fact that he did this and he did that outside of the marriage world, big deal, you know. I think it was a big deal to his wife, and maybe it wasn't a big deal to them because they're younger and they think, oh, well, that's cool, whatever. But even though this docudrama, and again, it's called The Staircase, it's written from the defense's point of view, I recommend everybody view this. It's sort of a fascinating look, and even you can see through some of the things, but it gives you a background of what really went on behind the scenes. His brother also happens to be an attorney, Michael Peterson, and, you know, they mortgaged the house to pay for this. His attorney was a very skilled guy, but, you know, he tried to turn over every rock. But, you know, in the end, and there was this big deal made of this fireplace blow poke that they hypothesized
maybe the owl picked up the blow poke and poked her with it. I mean, you know, it's amazing some of the theories that come up when if you just use logical common sense sometimes, that tells you everything. It really does.
But you know, if you have to be indoors for a few hours and you want to sit down and just have a marathon, I definitely recommend this movie. Not to laud Michael Peterson, but just to understand for somebody that has the means what kind of a defense they can get, and just kind of what transpired. So it is kind of fascinating. So with that in mind, that is totally a shatter of epic proportions, I think, Delilah.
Oh,
you know, we've
gosh.
Discussed four different movies here, and I don't know whether our listening audience looks at movies in terms of that. I know I'm an obsessed person about the old Law and Order shows. I just love those. Someday we'll just have to do a show just with regard to TV shows, because I know you love that. We could talk a lot about that. But in the last few minutes here, we've got about 11 minutes. Why don't I give a little preview of what's coming up on Shattered Lives? How's that? So that people, please go to your little cubbies and get your paper and pencil if you want to write these down. So you'll be sure to tune in. And I hope you tune in every week, but just in case – here are some things, what they used to call in the movies, the coming attractions, right, Delilah?
Right.
And if you want to make any comments on these people, feel free. Okay, next week we have Dwayne Bowers, and he is a trauma specialist. And I know he has worked extensively with some people from the Q Center, correct? And he's all, but his claim to fame kind of is he's worked with a lot of survivors from 9/11. And
mm-hmm.
going
I can't
to talk
say enough about
yeah.
him. He has done a lot of wonderful work with families of the missing, which is always near and dear to my heart.
Right.
And also, I'll just put a plug in real quick. Upcoming in August, I believe, is the Project Jason Keys to Healing Retreat that they put on every year. It's in Omaha, and
mm-hmm.
it's specifically for families with missing loved ones. And Dr. Bowers is there, and they do, you know, it's just a very healthy caretaking time that
yes.
they totally, totally deserve. And I know a lot of the families that have been to the retreat before and have talked with Dr. Bowers, and they just have tremendous
yeah.
things. So I'm very excited to have him on the show next week.
I think so, too. He's going to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, but he's also going to talk about, and this is something I identify with, because people to this day still say, well, Donna, why do you do this? Why haven't you moved on? There's a concept called post-traumatic stress growth with a G instead of a D. And this is what we're doing. We're taking our experience and we're using it for the greater good. We're doing healthy things. We're moving on. Post-traumatic stress growth. So I'm really anxious to talk about that. The next week, on the 2nd of June, we have a couple of recruits from the Q Center conference that we went to, Delilah, and that's going to be Robin Moore, who has special search and rescue dogs from Tennessee, and Chuck Elgin, who's a really cool guy, who has this special sonar technology that they, in fact, use on a search when we were there at the conference. And I just called him last week to say hi. And, you know, he's a wonderful guy, very hospitable, very excited about coming on. And he's a former DJ, so he's not afraid of the radio. You know, so we've got them coming up. Next, we've got Kim Ankland, our favorite female PI, coming up on June 9th, and she's going to talk about lawsuits because she specializes in civil lawsuits and sexual harassment. She's going to talk about personally what went on in her life. Unfortunately, she had a workplace sexual harassment experience. And warning about, you know, people going into these things lightheartedly because it's a very arduous situation. So Kim and I are simpatico, and I'm very glad that she's coming on to talk about that. And the next week on the 16th, for those people in Connecticut that know this woman, and she's a special friend of ours, through Dr. Bill Pettit, is Ann Baldwin, who is a media specialist, a media consultant. She has her own consulting company. She used to be an NBC anchor, and she was also the media person dealing with the Pettit family tragedy. And how do you get through a situation like that and keep the media sharks away from you when you've lost your entire family? So she's going to talk about experiences with respect to being an anchor and with respect to how do you negotiate with the media, and why did she change from being an anchor to a person with her own consulting company? There are specific reasons why, and I think it would be very interesting to talk to her. The next week we have Bob Ron, the partner of Kim Anklin, PI partner rather, not personal partner, and he's going to bring on a cold case for us, and we're still working out the details of that, of who it will be, but he's we're both mutual fans of each other. At least he likes all my Facebook postings, so he can come on anytime he wants. And I'm sure that that's going to be a really good show as well. The next week we have, let's see, we've got about 5.5 minutes here. June 30th, we've got, oh, this is really special to me because Delilah has also made me, I'm getting to be a diehard missing and human trafficking person like she is. And we have a homegrown author here by the name of Raymond Bichard, who is a wonderful author and has written a one-of-a-kind book called The Berlin Turnpike. And that has to do with an interstate highway here and about a famous trial that took place with one of the first human trafficking episodes, or shouldn't I say episodes, but one of the human trafficking stories that went to court here in Connecticut. And they also just did an experimental play a few weeks ago that I went to in Hartford, and it was wonderful. And there will be a blog coming out about that when Delilah puts it up. And maybe before he comes on, it might be a good time. But that's going to be a great show because the book is fantastic. We're into July. This is what we have going on. Let's see. Oh, you can talk a little more about this, Delilah, because you're more familiar with these guests. This has to do with a missing person case, a mother by the name of Alice Donovan and her daughter, Angie, a survivor, would love to be able to tell her personal story. I think she went through a lot of personal trials and tribulations in dealing with that. Do you have some other details you can add about them, Delilah?
Yeah, Angie, you know, not too often do we find guests who come on that, you know, especially families of missing loved ones who have gone from point A to point B all the way. In Angie's mother's case, she was taken at gunpoint out of a Walmart parking lot in Conway, South Carolina. The murderers were caught. They went to two different trials, so she's had, you know, that traumatic experience to go through. They're both on death row, but yet wouldn't give up the information. So 6 years later, that information came from one of them, and her mother's remains were finally found. And I think, you know, Angie can speak best as to what happened in her life during those 6 years and, you know, what was it like before, what's it like now, what was, you know, what did she do to cope, and how did she get through this with her and her sister?
Well, that's going to be a very powerful show.
I think it will. Angie, I'm very close with her and went through a lot of, you know, the trials and tribulations towards the end of the story. I didn't know her, you know, at the beginning when her mother was first kidnapped. But
that's great.
Was able to facilitate a little bit there for her. So anyway, she definitely will be an interesting guest.
That's great. Yeah. The next week we're going to have our beloved Monica Kayfoot on. She's either going to bring on a particular case she'd like to feature who is missing with a family, or we're contemplating talking about the actual intake process and what is it that they do with respect to when they go out and do search and rescue from her standpoint. I think that might be interesting, so we'll have to see. The next week after that, the 21st of July, we have another homegrown Connecticut author, and I'm in the process of reading the book now. It's called Clueless in New England by Michael Dooling. And he has written a wonderful book, very interesting, a historical book on three women that went missing from the 1940s to the 1950s. And they all started by hitchhiking in one way or another. And what their stories were, they're still unsolved stories, but he did a plethora of research in order to try to tie this together. And from them being that old and all being in New England, I think it's fascinating to me anyway, because that's where I'm from. So we're having him. Let's see, the next, then we have David Francis, whose son, John Francis, was also at the Q Center. David was presenting on his son who was killed, went missing as a mountaineer, and he has his own organization, and that's going to be wonderful. But I see that our time is fast running out. I'll have to give you an update next week with further ones. So, Delilah, I want to say thank you so much for co-hosting with me, and we're going to look forward to another week of wonderful guests. And in the meantime, please go to www.donnagore.com and Imagine Publicity. And good night, everyone. We'll see you next Saturday. Bye-bye.